How you doing? My name's Doug. I'm an alcoholic. Happy to be here. My sobriety date is January 5th, 2003. And I think it was the last time, or maybe two times ago, we went on a commitment together. And you brought your baby to the commitment. And it was funny because, you know, I can't get people to go on commitments. And I was talking about that for a long time in New Hampshire. I went with this woman. She had to bring her baby, you know. But she was doing it, you know. It's kind of weird being here, you know, in New Jersey. And it's driving down here, you know, it's... I haven't been speaking a whole lot, you know. It's funny, I think to myself, I know I'm going to put on a lot of, like, AA speakers. I'm going to get really spiritual. And I'm going to, you know, sound really good, right? And I laugh at myself when I say this because I know it's complete bullshit because it doesn't work. I can never be something I haven't had an experience with. I can't, you know, I can't think myself spiritual. I can't think myself sober, you know. I went to visit my daughter at graduation. I drove to Minnesota, and I drove by myself, and it was great. I loved it. It was a lot of fun. I had my iPod, and I packed it full of stuff. I had like 8 hours of Eckhart Tolle, and if you've ever listened to Eckhart Tolle, you gotta like listen to it. Well, I gotta rewind it. What? What did he say? And I'm listening to all this stuff, and I'm thinking to myself, when this trip's over, I'm going to be the most spiritual guy in the world. You know? Meanwhile, somebody cuts me off. I'm like, fuck you. Oh, that didn't work. So much for that. But, boy, what it was like. Jeez, we were just talking about, you know, in this town. I remember... in this town, you know, I kind of grew up here, or this is where I was when I was supposed to be growing up. After having moved around a lot, you know, I ended up here in fifth grade. And, you know, towards the end of that, I wasn't happy with who I was. And so I had to become a certain person. And I wasn't proud of somebody who was, like, from Chatham Township. You know what I mean? I didn't want you to know that I had all these privileges and stuff, so I worked really hard to go downhill as soon as I got out of this town. And, you know, I ended up over in Kenville, you know, hanging out at the Dart Inn, you know, in the pits. It was successful at changing my persona, you know, from the outside a little bit anyway. But what it was like was... I had a, you know, good family, two older brothers, and we moved around a bit until we landed here in New Jersey, quite a bit. And then, as a kid, I've heard other people say this. Things were cool. I felt okay, and maybe I felt connected. And a lot of sports going on. You know, my brothers were much older than me, and you know, I just sort of followed them around, and everything seemed to be all right. And I don't know what happened. At some point, maybe the dog, I remember the dog dying, and then all of a sudden, like, the fear of, oh my God, death happens, you know. That was injected into me. And then the three or four times that we had to move from where we were, that, you know, the loss of friends, it's like, oh my God, it was like devastating, you know. I'm going to die if I leave my friends. So all the fears of the world maybe started accumulating on me at some point. And, you know, we ended up here in Chatham. And once again, I walk into the school class just like this. The teacher brings me up. You know, here's Doug. He's a new kid. It was never the beginning of the year. It was always right in the middle of the year, you know, in front of the class. And I always felt different then. And, you know, I was good in sports. I was smart. I wasn't ugly, but still, I didn't measure up. And I remember this. And this is before alcohol, you know. I don't know why that was. Or, you know, what came first, the neuroses or the alcoholism. I don't know. And I can remember having this revelation one day. I think I was sitting in a meeting or somewhere, and I'm thinking, yeah, my first drinking episode was quite like the nine-step promises, you know. And, you know, it was like I comprehended the word serenity, and, you know, and I thought this was like a revelation that no one had ever thought of before in AA. I'm like, guess what? You know, so I'm going around talking about my spiritual experience, which was my first drink, my first drunk. You know, and it was like those promises in the ninth step. You know, I comprehended the word serenity. I understood. I had a new freedom. You know, things that used to baffle me, I didn't care about. I could talk to women. I could tell jokes. I felt okay. And I guess before that, I didn't know sobriety sucked. But after that, I thought, wow, sobriety does suck. You know, it was like you don't know what you know until you do it, and that's what happened. All of a sudden, I realized sober sucked because being drunk was great. It didn't matter how sick I got. I think I, you know, I drank alcoholically from the first time. You know, I was a maniac. And who did I become? I was always trying to be somebody, buy you with candy or whatever. And so I became this, like, maniac person, you know. And I was always doing crazy stuff. And this was the role, like, I adopted for myself. And it fit in very well with alcoholism. And I barely made it through high school. And you know, Jim and I went to high school together, and there are many drunken episodes around that. And God, it was nightmarish. But but some of it was fun. You know, in the beginning, it was fun. And Tom used to live down the street, and I'd be running down to his house for stuff all the time. You know? It's funny being here. I was probably drunk in this building. You know, at a wedding or something. You know, if I was at a wedding, I was drunk. I guarantee you that. But, you know, I barely made it out of high school. You know, I think I had to go to summer school to graduate after high school, you know. And I have a very high IQ. But, you know, I was having these anxiety attacks in high school and self-doubt. And, I'd start shaking. If I had to speak in front of class, my heart would start pounding and I'm freaking out. And, Jesus, I had to drink. And, you know, I made a decision, I think, to turn my life and my will over to the search for alcohol and more alcohol, you know. And I went to just about any length I could to chase alcohol. And, you know, as soon as I got out of here, I got an apartment in a horse farm over in Oldwick. And I was 18, and I had my own apartment. And I'm taking care of these horses at the horse farm, and there's one horse. They used to leave me there alone in the winter, and there's this one horse that I used to drink with. It's funny, but it is sort of pertinent. It was my realization later that it was an unconscious connection to my higher power, and that. This horse named Cowboy loved to drink, and the horse drank schnapps, and it wouldn't stop unless I put the bottle down. It would drink the whole thing, and I drank Yukon Jack, and I chased it with beer, and I'd hop on this horse, and we'd cross Route 523 over there in Oldwick, and it was fairly busy at the time, and I'm a blackout drinker. It must have been like a week of drinking, and then I'm a blackout drinker, you know, like the rest of my life pretty much. And so I'm on this horse, I'm across the street, I'm in the woods, I'm John Wayne, you know, and I don't know what happens next because I black out. But invariably, you know, what always happened was I woke up in Cowboy's stall, and it was either later that night or the next morning, you know. And the horse somehow was connected to God, and I was connected to the horse, and we made it back alive. Somehow that horse crossed that highway and got back into the barn and back into his stall, and it was amazing. I didn't die, and I got in relationships, and I am so clueless to this day about relationships. And early on, you know, I talk about this because it's very recent. I hooked up with this girl. I think we went to the Water Gap with some friends and we were drinking, and then we slept together, and then we ended up moving in together. And I I didn't like her at all when I was sober. And, you know, I was like a like an emotional thief, you know. I took what I wanted from her when it was, you know, convenient for me or when it felt good for me. And because I couldn't be there for this person when I was sober. And she drank a lot, and that helped. But we did a lot of fighting, and the relationship ended badly, you know. I ended up seeing somebody else and told her to get lost, you know. She loved me a lot. And it wasn't long after that that she died. She passed away from bulimia or anorexia or something like that. She died in the hospital. She got in another screwy relationship and then ended up dying. But on my way down here today, I tried to find out where she was buried, you know. And I called her mom. I got her mom's number through a friend and called her on my way down today. And it was an emotional conversation, you know. I'm thinking she's not going to remember me because, you know, this is 30 years ago and almost 30 years ago. But she did. She remembered me. And she told me that I was like her daughter's one true love, you know. And I was like, oh, man, that's a bummer. And it's funny to think of it. It's sad that that screwed up person that I was back then was her one true love. But I found the cemetery. I tried to go there and make some kind of amends, but I couldn't get in, and there was no way I was going to find it. But it hit me very hard to think about what I was to women at that time. You know, I wasn't accountable. I went through a lot of these relationships where I didn't want to be there, and I was, you know. I was a bad drunk, and you know, I got in the construction business, and a lot of the guys drank in construction, and you know, and I loved it, you know. I tried to juggle it, and like I said, I'm going downhill from Chatham, you know, and I think I'm doing it on purpose. I couldn't lower my standards fast enough to keep up with the progression. You know, but I was trying, believe me. I thought I'd found the cure when I got zapped one day at work. I'm working with a bunch of carpenters, and they're all drunks, and I'm plugging in some wet cords, and I get zapped, and my hangover's gone. And I'm like, the lights came on, you know. It was like a cool wind blew through and through. I thought I had the solution, you know, and I don't think I'm insane. So I rig up this deal that I can electrocute myself first thing in the morning. And because I'm a smart guy, right? And how smart am I? Well, it doesn't work the second time. It doesn't even work the seventh time. So I don't recommend it, you know? Jesus, I heard a cure on the radio the other day. They now, you know, the Antabuse, they got that where they can implant you with this thing. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God. Talk about suicide rate going up. Can you imagine a real alcoholic, no spiritual experience, implanted with Antabuse? That's like, give me the gun. You know? And speaking of, you know, coming to AA and not having a spiritual experience, I started coming to AA early, like 1981, 82, somewhere around there, with my DWIs, you know. Yeah, they sent me, right? And I had lost my license, and I got a birth certificate from a friend, you know. Dyed my hair red, put on big glasses, and I became Tim Finn for like 2 years. And I still drove, you know. I skirted around the consequences, but I would gladly tell you I'm an alcoholic, and my friends saw it, and it was funny, you know. I gradually, with the progression, my friends would disappear, You know, there was like me in a dot in this circle of friends. You know, they were all around. And then, like, the dots were disappearing. You know, and in the end, there's just me. You know, they would go away. And I'm coming into AA. And I would tell you, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. But, you know, and all this crap started with the but, you know. But I, you know, I got an apartment. I work hard. I still drive. You know, somebody else's license, but I'm still driving. You know, justification to keep alcohol in my life because it was my God. Because me, without alcohol, sucked. I couldn't be with you. I couldn't talk to you. I couldn't be the person I thought I needed to be. The person I thought, you know, I needed to be was the guy who was drunk. But I always missed the mark and always went way over. But I didn't have that idea of powerlessness down. I didn't really come to AA because I wanted to. I didn't surrender. I didn't have the first step down, you know. That first step. We ate some Chinese food tonight, and my fortune cookie was take the first step. Well, I did that in many forms of drinking. I was taking it. I was pouring it down. And coming in and out of AA, I couldn't stay here. And the problem was sobriety. I couldn't equate sobriety and happiness together in the same words, you know. I thought that if I put the drink down, well, things are going to get better. But they didn't. They always got worse. So I couldn't stay in sobriety. And I had never been shown a solution, or as it was laid out in the big book. No one had ever talked about that, or I didn't hear it. I don't know. Maybe it was me. But I ended up moving around the country, you know, taking another girlfriend hostage. And, you know, I went to a bar, and she was in my bed the next morning, and we stayed together for like the next 14 years. And that was the basis of the relationship, you know. And I ended up in New Hampshire. And I am, you know, I'm drinking myself to death, worse and worse. And then, and I don't know anybody in New Hampshire. I had moved from here to, I'd moved to Minnesota for a while and tried to repair an old relationship, and that didn't work. And I had moved to North Carolina for like 7 years, and I knew like maybe five people in North Carolina, and the whole 7 years I was there. And I finally, there were no bars down there like New Jersey. Like, you couldn't go to the bar and get a shot and a beer. You know, you had to like order food or something, you know. But I found this place where they gave you a key, and you become a member of this club, you know, and you could drink like you could in the dives up here. And it was great. I did, you know, but I didn't know those people. I would go into these bars and I would drink sort of, I'd have to restrain myself for an hour or 2 hours and drink almost like I was a social drinker, then leave and hit the bottle that was in my truck, you know, that I left. And in the beginning, and well, down there, I didn't know anybody. And like I said, I was working for myself as a carpenter, and I couldn't even hire anybody because sometimes I just had to leave the job and get drunk. And then we decided we're going to move to New England because I always wanted to move to New England, and we were getting sick of the heat. And I lived in New Hampshire for about 4 years, and I didn't know anybody. I knew like three people in the 4 years I was up there, because I was just, I got to a place where I was drinking just by myself. It was almost like, you know, those old movies where the wolf man knows it's a full moon, you know, and he's got to lock himself in the cell. And that's the way my drinking got. You know, in the beginning it was fun, and I was going out to the party, and I was getting primed for the party. In the end, it was oblivion. It was just, there was no in-between anymore. There was no stopping at the bar. It was just oblivion right away. And, you know, I drank Yukon Jack, and it got me there quickly. And the girlfriend had left and left me with my dog, and it was me and my dog. And I'm looking around at a house I had bought because I work really hard, and, you know, with all these justifications. And I tried all those gymnastics that I, everything in my life that I could do to somehow keep alcohol in my life, I tried. You know, wine coolers, Jesus, and wine. I couldn't drink beer. I couldn't just get drunk on beer. It just took me too long, you know? And I tried mixing it with drugs, but, you know, booze was my thing. And it took me to that place where I needed to go, which was dead, nowhere, not even alive on the planet. And I didn't even know it. And I thought I had to live like that. And I would detox for days and then go to work for like 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. And then I'd drink for like 5 days. And when the girlfriend left, it really started going downhill. And I'm alone. I'm in my house. And I'm like puking blood. And, you know, I had already been told by a doctor that my liver was in bad shape. And my reaction was, that's awesome. Because now I'm going to quit. Obviously, self-knowledge, right? It availed me nothing, you know? I even told my mom. I said, Mom, guess what? This is really good news. The doctor says my liver's in really bad shape, and now I'm going to quit. She's like, not so sure that's good news, you know, but okay. You know, and then I'm drinking again, you know? But in the end, I was puking blood, and I was yellow. My eyes were yellow. I was alone with my dog in my house, and the curtains were all drawn. The phone was off the hook. I wasn't answering it. Some people from California were coming over to get me, and I don't know anybody from California, but I knew they were coming to get me. I still had almost a full, like, half gallon of Yukon Jack, and my relationship with God was about when I got in a lot of trouble. I really needed God. I need you to get me out of this, God. Or, you know, I'd call God when things were really, really bad and I wanted help. And this was one of those times I hit my knees. And as far as God went, I didn't go to churches, you know, maybe weddings. I had a lot of contempt for organized religion and the Bible and what I thought, you know, like Bill Wilson talks about Jesus Christ. I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claim him. That was my deal too, you know, and everybody talked about this, but I didn't see him walking it, and I didn't go for it. But still, I'm hitting my knees and praying to God, which is, I think, where God takes us as alcoholics, to that place first. And that's where I was. And that's when I understood what powerless was completely. That's when I had that first step down. And I asked him for help. I didn't drink any more of that bottle. I actually poured it out. And I made it to an AA meeting, January 5th, 2003. And this time I came with the idea that I had surrendered. I had conceded, you know, to my innermost self that I was powerless over alcohol. You know, there had been many times in the past where I admitted, you know, I looked at the steps, wherever they were. Oh, yeah, number one, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Doug. Got that one down. You know, it was an outward admission. But internally, I was always, nah, I'm a little smarter than a lot of these people, you know. I had a lot of lurking notions that, yeah, when I get out of here, I'm probably going to drink, you know. It's probably not going to work out for me. But I got to AA and came with desperation. And I would have done anything anybody told me at that point. And I walked into a meeting. I quickly got a sponsor. I didn't take any time trying to listen to anybody. I just found a guy with 25 years of sobriety and asked him to be my sponsor, and he said he would. And we had a good relationship. We're still good friends. We play guitar a lot together, and we're both carpenters, and we share a cabinet shop. And, you know, and he He let me ride his Harley early in sobriety. That was big. It was really big. I felt a sense of responsibility. But whenever I talked about, because I'd been in an AA and out so much that I, you know, and I'd always done everything half-assed my whole life and never fully carried it through, that I really wanted to do this thing. And I talked about, what about these steps? When are we going to do them? Well, we don't need to do them. And he was a man who apparently is not as sick as I, because he can stay sober in fellowship. And I had proven to myself that I couldn't. And that you know, set off a little alarm bell in my head. Okay, so I'm going to do this half-assed again. And with the fellowship came this idea of how isolated I was. I told you I knew like five people in North Carolina. I knew like four in New Hampshire. That was like my whole life for like the last 11 years. And now I got all these people that I know in AA, and it was, there was some power behind it. And there was the idea that I had the first step down. But my internal condition was getting worse as time was going by, and I was going to a lot of meetings. And I wasn't doing anything to address my internal condition. And coming up on a year of sobriety, I was like right out of my mind. And I knew it. And, you know, I heard somebody say, you know, that all the slogans in AA, you know, think, you know. And that's the one I was doing all the time. You know? I'm thinking. I can't stop thinking. I couldn't stop thinking. My mind was like a freight train. And it wouldn't shut down. And it seemed to be going faster all the time. And it was that silence that I got to in the end of my drinking very quickly. You know, that just that place that was total darkness that I missed. And I heard some different things from some different people. I ended up running into Jim at a meeting in Summit that I had just picked out of the book. And I saw people were doing something differently. I met some people from Boston who were doing something differently. And, you know, Jim asked me some questions, like, how's it going? And I was like, it's going great, awesome, great. I had a lot of meetings all the time. Meetings, 90 and 90, you know. You think of 90 and 90, the ratio is not that good. When you think of 90 hours out of 2,070, it's not that good compared to the time we spent drunk in those 2,070 hours, you know. But he said, so are you praying? No, I wasn't praying. I wasn't meditating. I wasn't sponsoring anybody. Been through the steps? Nope. My sponsor's got a Harley. You know? Tells me I don't need him. And he said something like, why don't you try AA? And it's funny, because I can remember being at our 10th high school reunion, and Jim was trying to 12-step me there. I was half in the bag and ready to leave, because I couldn't drink like I had to at the high school reunion. And I forget what he said, but what I thought was along the lines of what Bill Wilson thought. Like, oh, they got him, that poor bastard. I was thinking about that the other day, and it came back to me. Oh, he's got religion or some damn thing. You know, that's what I thought. But and I think, you know, I left here with some different ideas and a resolve that I wasn't going to do this thing half-assed anymore. And I sought the solution with more desperation than I was. You know, because I'd been hearing easy does it, you know, and I was being told to apply that to my program. And I was told I was going to be sick for a really long time, like 5 years. And it was going to be 2 years before I could sponsor anybody. And, you know, I heard a lot of stuff that was mythical. And I went through the steps, and something happened. And, you know, I didn't even know something was going to happen. But it really, it changed everything for me. I got involved with a group of guys who were going through the steps in like 10 weeks. And that's how I went through the steps thoroughly. And I don't know how to explain it, but I had a spiritual awakening as the result of those things. And I still had that contempt in AA when I got into it, when I heard the God word. Many times I was out the door and used it to drink. And, you know, oh, they're all about God. And what that really meant was, I'm not done yet. and I hadn't surrendered. That was a translation of those words out of my mouth. And I didn't know what God was or anything, but I had this small little spiritual awakening that sounds kind of stupid, but it's the way it happened for me. I was sitting, getting my car repaired, and reading one of those auto mechanic magazines, Popular Science or something, and there's a picture on the cover of this really high-tech car where the doors open up, you know, and it's really high technology. And I'm thinking to myself, this is like, wow, this is like the ultimate, you know, man's technological creation. And a ladybug landed on my arm. And I was looking at the ladybug, and the paint job was perfect. And it was shiny, you know, just clean as a whistle. And the shell opens up, and the wings come out, and it flies away. And, you know, they hear this, like, little voice in my head saying, that's just a bug, you know. And that was, a little God experience for me. It sort of opened my mind to what God might be. And, you know, the third step became demystified when I was told that, you know, this is nothing but a decision. And when I took it, when I said this prayer, I didn't really understand, you know, the importance of it, you know. And I like to talk about turning my will and my life over the care and direction of God, like the original manuscript, because I think the other one just might imply that I'm just going to sit in the chair and have God take care of me. And, you know, what happened in that third step was, I just did this thing and picked up a pen and began looking at myself. And, you know, like Chuck Chamberlain talks about uncovering, discovering, and discarding, or something like that. And that's what it was all about for me. And I was just, like, looking at all my crap and finding out what really wasn't going to fit with what my idea of God was, or what God's idea was for me in the first place. And I was thorough, and I shared this stuff, and I said that seven-step prayer. I had a list of amends I was going to make, and I began going about doing them. And I couldn't believe what was going on. I had this spiritual awakening somewhere in my ninth step amends, like halfway through. It was really where all the lights came on. You know, before that, I'm thinking, well, this is cool. I'm going to have a lot to talk about in AA. And I'm going to sound really good now or whatever. But then all the lights came on and I got it. It wasn't about me. And, you know, I have all sorts of ideas about God. And I've heard people say that what the alcoholic, the addict, was looking for in the first place was, you know, that feeling of God. And I think I couldn't get close to God till I began removing things that blocked me from people in my life first, you know. And I believe that's what began happening to me. I began, you know, just making these amends, and I got lighter. I started to walk a little taller. My perspective on the world started to change, and I couldn't believe it. I heard this. You know, I keep thinking. So many times in my life, I've struggled with, well, what is God? How do you define God? I can't define God, but I heard somebody say once that God is the unlimited potential of everything that ever was, everything that is, and everything that could be, and it's funny, because when I was living around here, everybody said things like, you got such potential. You know, potential is what you got when you have nothing, really. And I've also heard that hell is distance from God. And that's when I was in hell, there was no God. You know, it was just the booze, and that's what it was. And when I began doing this stuff, you know, the lights started coming on. My perspective, my ideas on life began to change. And, you know, Eric and I were talking about perspective. I remember the last time he was talking about his job. And he said, God, it's really boring. It's, you know, it sucks, you know. And I this was maybe a year ago, and I asked him today, how's it going? He goes, it's not bad. It's the same job, but it's not bad. You know? That's a change in perspective. I was up on my roof in New Hampshire 2 weeks ago because I'm putting a new roof on my house. And I'm always thinking to myself, I never take a vacation. I never get to go to the beach. You know, the beach is an hour away. I never go. And all these mountains, I don't go hiking, you know. And I have two kayaks, and I don't go kayaking because I'm always working. And I'm up on my roof on a Sunday. It's like 70 degrees out. And my girlfriend works with me, and she's up there roofing with me too. And I'm thinking to myself, man, this is awful. You know, it's such a nice day, and I'm up here roofing. I'm looking straight down at the shingles, you know, and the plywood. And I stopped for a minute, and I looked out and up and out. And looking out from the back of my house, we got two horses. We got chickens. And there's mountains and forests. And you can see one church steeple maybe about 20 miles away. And then there's other mountains. I should be paying a view tax, but they haven't caught up to me. And my perspective changed. It did a complete 180. I went, oh my God, I get to roof this house. And it's mine. I live here, you know, in New Hampshire. Look at this. This is God everywhere. It's all around me, you know, and I'm not even seeing it. And that was a spiritual experience. And I put my head down and went back to work happy. Joyous. And I worked till dark, you know. And that's what happened. And I can do that. And I can still, if I don't practice these principles in all my affairs, they're not right there on the surface. Because the next Sunday I was up there again. I go, why am I up here? Why am I roofing again? I said, oh yeah, but it came right back. Because I had that. And it did come back in the way it did in the same way it did before. By me turning my thoughts towards, you know, God, and doing this for not just for me but for other people, help, you know, and my mom, and helping other people. When I started talking with Jim and he started sponsoring me, he told me to find people to help, you know. And that's the one thing I would tell anybody, that's the apple that I think I was looking for in the beginning, the big prize, you know. People talked about the tools in their toolbox, you know. Well, that's the coolest tool. I'm a carpenter. I'm into cool tools. I would say that's the coolest one, working with others, you know. And don't let anybody tell you that you don't have enough time or whatever to use that tool, because it's the best tool. And he's like, seek out a place like a rehab or something like that up down. I live in New Hampshire. There's nothing up here but chickens, horses. But I found a place. I found a sober veterans home. And I started going there once a week, and it was like 100 miles. It was a 100-mile night when I went there and back. But I started going there first, and I started bringing people with me to help me speak there and whatever. Then nobody was coming with me anymore. And I was going alone. And so I started bringing them to meetings, and I started sponsoring some of these guys. And, you know, the first time somebody asked me to sponsor him. This guy, Bill, he's a big, huge guy. And, you know, he was like this, and he was drooling on his shoulder. And he always wanted to talk, and it just, when he talked, this stuff came out. And he never knew what it was going to be. And it was going to go on for a long time. And he was right out of his mind, you know. This guy was a Vietnam vet who was in a helicopter crash, and everybody died but him, you know. And he was a sad case, and he'd been in institutions his whole life, jail and institutions. And he was never free, you know. And he came up to me and asked me to sponsor him. And I went, oh, crap. And, you know, in my mind, I went, oh, no, not Bill. Right? But that was God's will, you know. And my will would have been, oh, no. But to follow God's will, I had to have the power to say, yeah, I'll sponsor you. And I did. I said, sure, okay. And I didn't know what I was doing, right? And so I'm calling Jim. What do I do now? You know, and it was simple. And it was cool because I had the humility to sit with Bill and say, I don't know what to do now. I'm going to call Jim. You know, he didn't care. So, who was it? I think it's Tom Flynn talks about, Jesus, don't, you know, he doesn't know and I don't. I know and you don't know, but he doesn't know. Don't let him know you don't know or whatever. Go help that man, but I don't know, you know, how to help him. Don't tell him that. Well, I told him that. He still didn't care. But what I did was, you know, he'd been going to AA for a long time, and I took him through the steps, and it was very thorough, and I sat with him in the basement of the home he lived at, and he cried, and I cried, and it was intense. And something happened to that man, and he had a spiritual awakening. He was supposed to stay there for a lot longer. And he talked to me. He said, I need to get out of here. I said, go ahead, get out of here. He got out against all medical advice. He stopped taking a lot of his meds. And today doesn't take any. He ended up getting married. He bought a house. He's still sober. It's unbelievable, you know, the gifts of this program. And, you know, I started taking a lot of actions that the old Doug wouldn't have taken. Based on helping others. And recently I got involved in, you know, a lot of my family life was not in order, like my own house. I wasn't paying attention to my girlfriend the way I should. I wasn't paying attention to her kids the way I should. And I started changing that and doing a little more work at home. And I got involved in Boy Scouts with her youngest son, Morgan, whose dad is completely out of the picture and doesn't have anything to do with him, and he calls me dad now, you know, and that's a gift of this program. I went to summer camp this year, and I got all this contempt. I'm like, oh my God, there's going to be a lot of weird guys there, you know, and I'm a weird guy, so. But they had this seminar, right, and this guy's talking about Boy Scouts, you know, and he's like, well, the Scout Oath is, you know, I got all these broken fingers, so I actually have to help that one over. They all point outward, you know, and it's, you know, there's only, the only selfish words in the Scout Oath are my. On my honor, I'll do my duty to do my best, to God and my country and to help other people at all times. And he's talking about this, and he goes, it's about God, you got to put God first, you know, and you got to help other people. And if you don't have God, you better get one. And he's saying this. And I'm sitting in a Boy Scout seminar going, yeah! You know? It's spiritual. And I was so afraid of kids. I thought they knew stuff I didn't know. I didn't know the jokes they were telling. I felt really dorky around kids. And I was scared to be around them. You know, the first time I had to do, I'm assistant scoutmaster now. First time I had to do the scoutmaster's minute, I'm freaking. You know? I talk in front of people in AA all the time, but I got to talk in front of these kids. This is not good. You know? But I've learned that I'm just okay. And it doesn't matter what I say or who I am, as long as I'm just trying to help somebody. And, you know, if I can say something that's going to change somebody's mind and make them think, Jesus, maybe I ought to get a sponsor and go through these steps, then that's cool. That's awesome. That's what it's all about. You know, this program. And I don't have any resentment towards the people that, you know, the guy who first sponsored me, you know, he maybe he's not an alcoholic, but he gave me everything he had. You know, he didn't have an experience with the steps. If he had had one, he probably would have given it to me. My resentment was like, you gave me all your toys, but not, you know, you didn't have the ones I wanted. You know? And I used to run around AA angry, but I don't anymore. Because if I'm angry, I'm separating myself from God first. And I'm separating myself from you. And then I'm separate from God. And I'm making a judgment. So my experience is my experience. And that's it. And that's all I have. you know. So I'd like to thank you for having me down here. I'd like to thank this group, which I feel affiliated with, a connection to. I'd like to thank Jim and all you guys for being here. Thanks.